Hello, my name is Kim Dorman, and I'm here to facilitate a conversation as part of the Voices of Princeton project. It's April 26th. We are in the Princeton Public Library, and this is a partner project with the Jewish Community Foundation of Greater Mercer. Today we have Lou Gantwerk, who is the interviewer, and Peter Epstein as the interviewee.
Good morning. My name is Lou Gantwerk, and I'm here to interview Peter. And Peter will introduce himself right now.
Hello, I'm Peter Epstein, and a prodigal son who returned to Princeton after 50 years and having grown up here as a child.
So we're going to start with a couple of questions that will talk to your experience here in Princeton and then move the conversation along. So tell us about your life in Princeton. How did it begin? How did you get here? How did your parents get here? And we'll take it from there.
Okay, sort of to frame my history and connection with Princeton, I came here, and I was born in 1941 and arrived here about 18 months later. At 17, I couldn't wait to get away because Princeton at that time didn't have any women as undergraduates, so I wanted to go someplace urban with women, and I just returned here about 7 or 8 years ago when I decided to 82.5% retire, and I still have family in the area. We moved here in 42 when RCA opened their laboratories out at the intersection of Route 1 and Washington Road. And RCA was really, I think, the first of the major corporate R&D centers to locate in the Princeton area. Prior to that, Princeton really just consisted of the university and ETS and the polling industry. I think Gallup Polls and Roper were here. I grew up on Jefferson Road in the first block off of Wiggins Street. It was quite a contrast with today. At that point, the street was filled with families with children. A large number of the neighbors were teachers at the high school who probably can't afford to live in Princeton anymore. But there was a math teacher, Mr. Shepherd, down the road, the Borgers, the Wilcoxes, the principal, Mr. Straub. The town itself was pretty much sleepy. They rolled up the sidewalks in the summer. But there were two supermarkets on Nassau Street. There was a butcher shop. There was a hardware store. There were family-owned pharmacies. Quite a contrast with the kind of outdoor shopping mall we have today.
Right. So you went to school in the Princeton Regional Schools through high school?
Yes, that's correct.
Could you say something about what that was like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I went to the elementary school, which at that point was located near the corner of Moore Street and Nassau in the stone building that the university took over and made the Arts Center before the Lewis Center was opened. And I think one of the notable events was that the schools were integrated when I was in the second grade with the famous Princeton Plan, which has always amused me. My sister, who you'll speak to later, I think went to Harvard Ed School, and they studied the Princeton Plan as a model for integration. And all it really consisted of at that time, the Nassau Street School was a white school from grades 1 to 8, and the Quarry Street School off of Witherspoon was the Afro-American school for grades 1 to 8, and all the Princeton Plan consisted of was making Nassau Street grades 1 to 5 for everybody and Quarry Street grades 6 to 8 for everybody. I'm not sure what other alternative they really had that would have made any sense. But as a probably 7 or 8 year old at the time, I barely noticed the change. You know, there were just a couple of new kids in the class come September.
And the high school, when you got there, what was that like for you?
Well, high school at that point, I think it had almost as many students. At that point, there were still separate school systems between the township and the borough. And the school had, they probably had almost as many students as now, but there must have been a dozen sending districts, you know, including West Windsor and Skillman. There was Future Farmers of America Club. There was an Italian-American Sportsman's Club. I think they had a hunting facility sort of behind where the shopping center, Princeton Shopping Center, is now. I think one thing that might be interesting to reflect on, what was unique about being in high school in a university town? One of the negative things for a young man was that a lot of the more attractive girls would, particularly when they were juniors and seniors, would go up to Firestone Library after school to try to be picked up by university undergrads. So we were competing with 3,000 undergraduates, you know, at the same time. I think that contributed to the fact that I think in my class, out of the top 25 students, 23 of them were women, because the girls would be up at Firestone Library, the guys would be out playing, shooting hoops in driveway basketball courts. On the other hand, the university had some unique attractions. We could go up to Firestone Library. It had open stacks in those days, so anybody could wander off the street and go down and use whatever books they could find. When we got to be 16, 17, one of the great sports was trying to sneak into the eating clubs and drink liquor on weekends. And then the annual reunions here were a huge event, which also provided many opportunities for serendipitously slipping into tents and getting served beer. And I can remember seeing Dave Brubeck playing in the corner of the class of 23 tent. I also earned income selling programs at football games at Nassau Stadium. So those were some of the unique aspects of being in a university town.
Did your we're also interested, of course, as you mentioned earlier, in the experience of being a Jewish kid growing up in Princeton. Did that manifest itself in ways that
you... Yeah, in many ways. I mean, first of all, I grew up thinking Epstein was a really distinct aristocratic name, and then at the age of 15, I saw the Brooklyn Phone Directory for the first time, and there were 20 pages of Epstein. It was like Smith. Might be interesting to describe the Jewish community when we first got here. It was located right close to the library on Spring Street in a little storefront. And about the only members, you know, I think before my father arrived, I don't think there were any actively Jewish faculty at that point. So almost the entire membership were either local retail owners, like Harry Ballett had a clothing store. Meyer Goldstein had a soda fountain. Another family owned the main pharmacy on Nassau Street. Another owned the chicken farm and the newspaper delivery service, I think the Peskins. And I think my father, and then there were doctors. There were the Abrams brothers. One was an eye doctor, another a dentist. There was Marion Robinson, who was a chiropodist. And I think my father was really the first sort of non-medical or legal professional to show up in town. And then my family's best friends growing up were the Bernsteins, and he was one of the first professors here. He was a professor of political science and then became dean of the Wilson School and then later president of Brandeis University. you know, on the one hand, I never encountered any direct anti-Semitism, but I was always extremely self-conscious about being Jewish, particularly when I got to the age of dating. You know, you often wondered if a girl wouldn't go out with you, whether it was your acme or the fact that you weren't Christian. In my class of over 300 students, there were only two students in the high school whose families were actively members of the Jewish congregation. There was Arnold Erkin, whose family owned a hardware store on Witherspoon Street, and myself. There were several other students whose families were ethnically Jewish, including a couple of very prominent sons of very prominent Princetonians, Oppenheimer's son Peter and David Wigner, who was the son of Eugene Wigner, who I think also was a Nobel Prize physicist, mathematician. One of my more amusing memories is that at that time the high school made some lame efforts to give equal time at the Christmas. In those days, pre-Supreme Court decision, we had elaborate Christmas events in the auditorium in the high school. And Princeton's claim to fame, the jewel of the school, was this 50 or 60 voice choir that got sent by the State Department to Russia and one of the most publicized activities in the school. And I remember the Christmas event in the auditorium where the choir got up and they sang all these, you know, great classics of the Christmas tradition, Hallelujah Chorus, the Noel, Come All Ye Faithful, with this, you know, 80 voices in harmony. And then Arnold Erkin and I got invited to get up and sing, Oh, Dreidel, 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 I Made It Out of Clay. Luckily, Arnold was a member of the choir and had a good voice, but that was one of the more embarrassing memories of growing up Jewish at Princeton. And unfortunately, you won't be able to interview my younger sister, Judith, who was about 7 years younger, but if I recall correctly, by the time she got to high school, there were numerous, you know, probably 15 or 20 students, and I think they actually even closed the high school on Yom Kippur. So it was an incredible transformation, I think, in the Jewish population shortly after I left for college.
Yeah, I mean, so your parents were instrumental in sort of raising the Jewish community in a more sort of thoughtful and conscious way.
Yeah, well, the transition was, you know, this congregation I described that was in the storefront in Spring Street was Orthodox. And it was so small they had trouble getting, you know, raising a minion for Friday night services. And then my father
just,
and other
just
people...
Just to clarify, just for people who will be listening, a minion consists of 10 people.
Right, it's the minimum number that you're required to officially hold a...
And it had to be all men, certainly.
All men,
in an Orthodox.
In those days, anyway.
Right.
My only memory of that synagogue was during World War II. It's maybe my first memory, actually, they had USO events there for Jewish servicemen that were at the university receiving training. And I remember being taken there in my little boy's Air Force uniform and sitting under a table and seeing the legs of men and women dancing. That's, I think, my earliest memory. In any event, my father and other people were instrumental in creating the Jewish Center, which at first, I think it was affiliated loosely with the conservative, they recruited their rabbis through the Conservative Association of Jewish Communities, but it was kind of embraced people that were, you know, from the whole spectrum, from Reformed through Conservative to Orthodox. And initially, they purchased on Alden Street a small chapel that had been the Christian Science Church. That's subsequently been torn down for various engineering department buildings. And it very inappropriately had an organ in it that was sometimes used for services. And so they were there for a number of years, and we had our Sunday schools where events were held at the Theological Seminary. And then my father was president of the community and instrumental in, he was president at the time they built the Jewish Center in a location where it still exists to this day, though the initial architecture was fairly prosaic compared to what exists now. One of my personal memories was that, my father was an electrical engineer, and aside from his passion for tennis, his involvement with the Jewish community was his main occupation outside work over the years. And when I was coming to be the age to be bar mitzvahed, which is a process, when you're 13, which is this initiation, the manhood ritual, and you usually started studying 6 months in advance with the rabbi to be prepared for your participation in a service where you were going to be anointed a man. In any event, and at that time my father was president of the Jewish Center, it was still in this ex-Christian Science Church on Alden Avenue. Anyway, about a few weeks before my scheduled bar mitzvah, I got up the courage to tell my father that I was an agnostic. And at that point, I was like 12 years old, and I thought I was the first person in the history of Western civilization to question the existence of God. But I got up the courage to tell my father, and to my surprise, I found I was an agnostic, but he was a dogmatic atheist. And for a while, it took me a while to reconcile. How could you devote your life to the Jewish Center and be such a hardcore atheist? But for him, it was just very important to be proud and celebrate your Jewish identity, and even though he had no religiosity. But as a result, he never really warmed up to any rabbi that was really emotionally religious. He wanted them to be more ethical professors, telling people, reflecting intelligently on current affairs.
There's a story that Barbara has told, and I think you and I talked about it also, about an encounter with Albert Einstein and a talk that you both
that's a hilarious story. I sort of dine out on this still to this day. My memories of Albert Einstein, I remember seeing, my personal memories are just of having seen him, I think, on his bicycle, and I think he also sailed a small boat in Carnegie Lake. And I have a vague recollection of being out in canoe or rowboat and seeing him in his sailboat. But I'm told, this is all not from any personal recollection, that my father was also president of UGA in the early days of Israel's existence, and Albert Einstein, even though he was not a member of the Jewish Center, he was, I think, on the board of the UGA, so he evidently came to our house on Jefferson Road. But the story you're alluding to was Martin Buber, who was a famous Austrian theologian, existential theologian, and wrote and talked in a fairly obscure way, came to Princeton to give a talk, and my father went there with one of his best friends. And at the end of the talk, they're getting up to leave, and my father turns to his friends and says, I couldn't understand a single word that man said. And this voice behind my father says, I couldn't understand a single word either. And my father turned around, and it was Albert Einstein.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
For the record, could you just tell us what your father's name was? Because he's an important...
Yeah, my father was Jess Epstein, and when he came to RCA, you know, RCA had a major facility down in Camden, and then they opened up the facility here in Princeton as a basic research center. And in those days, unlike today, where there was less obsession with quarterly earnings reports, a lot of the research was long-term that didn't have any, you know, near-term plausible commercial application. But my father was in charge of the group developing transmitters, and they had a little facility off by themselves in a field behind the main RCA facility. And it was sort of pre-air conditioning days. And I remember we used to drive out there to pick them up after work, and the men would be working in their undershirts and underpants in the dog days of July and August. And my father's major claim to fame in my recollection is that they custom constructed the main transmitting tower on top of the Empire State Building, which sort of expanded the area that could receive TV signals from New York. And my father, and they transported it in sections to New York City, and my father spent a month or two in New York supervising the installation. So I always conflate my father with King Kong fighting off the bomber planes. So,
at 17, you decided you'd had enough of Princeton and needed to spread your wings, so to speak.
Yeah, so I didn't apply to Princeton, and then literally 60 years later almost, or 55 years later, I decided to come back here. I think it was because I had gotten, maybe 15 years early, gotten divorced, and then had moved into an apartment, and I'd lived in big cities all my adult life, and then I lived overseas, and so I think there was something, I felt kind of uprooted. I didn't own, I'd sold my house after we separated, and I was living overseas and working for 10 or 15 years, and so I think there was a feeling of a magnetism to come back and get connected to hometown USA after having been so transient a lot of my adult life. And I still had my sister, and my mother was still alive at that point as well.
Mm-hmm. So are there other highlights of the 17 years you spent in Princeton that were important in, you know, formative years or experiences or ways in which this town, you know, even after 60 years of being away, still felt like home to you in some ways?
Yeah. I found the town profoundly changed in ways that were both good and bad. I mean, the negative was I sprung for the cost of buying a house in a location where I could walk in 5 minutes up to Nassau Street, and then discovered that I had to get in a car to go to a supermarket or or a hardware store. And on the other hand, Princeton is sort of a lively year-round city now, which is attractive. I think it might be interesting just to mention my mother as well a little bit, because she had a very prominent role in Princeton, and her history kind of mirrors the history of women's transition from the post-war era into women's liberation and beyond. So she was born in 1915, so she was probably in her 30s when she came here, late 20s. And she, unusual for a woman of her period, had a PhD in mathematics. Actually more educated than my father, who had a master. She had a PhD from kind of a prestigious university. He had a master's degree from University of Cincinnati. But when we were small children, she just worked part-time at ETS, writing math questions for SATs and other exams. And But she was very active in the community, so she was president of the League of Women Voters for years, and she was chairman of the Princeton, the high school school board, and much later years she was on the State Board of Education. But after I was the oldest, and after myself and Barbara, who was the next oldest of the three of us children, were off to university, and I think this must have been in the mid-60s, the late-60s, and opportunities were beginning to open up for women. And at that point, my mother went to work full-time for the math section of ETS, eventually became the head of it, and then she had this meteoric career very late in her life and ended up being senior vice president of ETS and in charge of the whole college board, ending up earning much more than my father ever earned. I think they had a comfortable retirement, much more due to her than to him. So that whole history kind of mirrored the transition of women during that epic. You know, and one of the consequences of it, I don't think you have things like, I think the more active, well-educated women now don't have time for things like the League of Women Voters, at least to the extent that that was a avocation of my mother for a number of years.
And your mother's name was?
Marion Epstein, Marion. Yeah.
Yes. I think putting your parents in that light as really sort of central to the evolution of the Jewish community and the way this community has continued to, the Jewish community has continued to evolve. So I guess, again, in terms of your, I'm interested in you've started this last section of your discussion, that you saw both sides of Princeton, both the positive stuff and the...
On my return, you mean.
Yeah. On your return. And so that'd be interesting to talk more about that, if there are other ways in which you could talk about what you've seen, what you see in the town at this point.
Well, it's interesting coming back. I think the other big change is it was... you know, to use the cliche of our modern time, it's actually in some ways more diversified in those days. We lived on Jefferson Road, and then a block over was Humbert Street, and that was almost 100% Italian-American working-class families, you know, the carpenters, the plumbers. And then you had the black community, which was over in the Witherspoon-John Street area. So the people that worked in support capacities, I imagine even, you know, cleaning ladies and certainly school teachers could afford, and policemen could afford to live in Princeton at those days. It also, you know, Princeton to me almost was like a little medieval town. It had good quality Gothic architecture. So as you came from Route 1, you just saw the Gothic spires emerging from the trees. And when I was in fifth grade, we moved out to what was known as Canassa Park. It was a large tract of land between Rolling Mead and just past Snowden Lane that extended out to Riverside. That at that point, and this must have been around early 1950s, was still just meadow and woods, second growth woods. And beyond that, there were farms going out from around Riverside out to Kingston and River Road. And that land was all purchased by employees at RCA and then subdivided into an area that was known as Canassa Park. And so my father bought land there. I remember in back of our house, there was just woods going down to the Little Brook itself. And when you went back in that woods, you would find the remnants of, in the midst of the honeysuckle and forest, there were the remnants of fruit trees. You would find fruit trees and sort of dilapidated chicken coops. So that had evidently all been farmed at one point and then had reverted to second growth forest. Little Brook School didn't exist then. That was all sort of a meadow where we would run around and play at that point. So the other thing of coming back was discover Princeton was now kind of enveloped in a megalopolis, you know, sort of one uninterrupted urban space from New York down to Philadelphia almost. So that's a real contrast from my childhood days as well.
I know that you shared your interest in tennis, and your father had a big interest in tennis. Did you guys ever get to play together?
Yeah, no, my father, they just worked very strictly 9 to 5 at RCA, and he had a routine where every Tuesday and Thursday and on the weekend, he played tennis after work. And then would come home and take a nap. And I, from a young age, I would go over and be a ball boy and hang out in the hope that he might play with me for 10 or 15 minutes after he finished playing tennis. So I picked up a little tennis. I played, in those days, tennis had not really become the sport it is today, especially outside of prep schools. So I was captain of the tennis team, and we actually came in second in the state in the championships. But we were actually, when I went off to an Ivy League university, I didn't have a chance of making the tennis team. The level of high school tennis was really pretty pathetic. The tennis courts there were all, not the kind of clay courts we have today, the sort of green gravelly courts. They were real just clay, hard-baked clay. And the university had about 10 or 15 courts that were down, pretty much down behind where the art museum is, down the hill from there. And then there were some other courts between the university just above the stadium. And the town would have a big tournament every summer that was held down in those courts near the stadium. The university at those days was very generous about sharing sports facilities with people from the town. So the whole time I was growing up, my father in the winter played squash over at the Dillon Gym, which now I think is just an undergraduate gym, not for the varsity sports. And I would hang out there and learned a little rudimentary squash as well. Wow. And, so one of the big challenges of my life was getting to the point where I could actually, you know, psychologically be at a point where I would defeat my father playing tennis.
Have you gotten there?
What? I did get there in my 20s at some point, you know. But he kept playing into his 80s, yeah. You know. But he picked up tennis late because he grew up in Cincinnati. Tennis was sort of perceived as a sissy sport. I think he was only 5 feet. He was about as short as I am, about 5'6" or 5'7". But he was on the starting varsity basketball team in Cincinnati in those days. I don't think that would be possible anymore either. And when he came here, he played baseball instead of tennis, but then picked up tennis in his late 30s, 40s.
So one of the other things that we could talk about a little bit is sort of how your Jewish identity has sort of evolved from the 12-year-old discovery of being agnostic to whatever age you are now and sort of connected. Yeah. You know,
well, I've always sort of been proud of being Jewish, and I've always identified with the tradition. And the parts of the Jewish liturgy that resonate me is more the traditional prayers in Hebrew. There are certain melodies that still resonate with me. I married a Korean American, and she was from sort of a lapsed Buddhist family. And so when we raised our children, it was interesting. At first, we didn't have any affiliation, but around the time my kids were getting to be 10 or 11, my wife took the initiative. She thought they needed some sort of connection with a moral, ethical tradition. And at first we tried, you know, which mixed marriage couples often do. We went to a Quaker community near us, and I just found it sterile. It didn't have the resonance of, you know, Burkato Ananoe, Bure Pri Hagafen. And so we actually ended up joining a Jewish community, and my kids were, I think my daughter was over 13, so, but she was, what's the term, not consecrated, anyway, she was certified in some way, and my son was actually bar mitzvahed, but that kind of lapsed, and I've never really been a formal member of a synagogue as an adult, but with my children, we always celebrated the main holidays. But for me, I always identified mostly with Passover, which is more a pagan rite of spring as much as it is a religious holiday. I have a couple of recollections of growing up with my father being a president of a Jewish center, which I think also might be of interest. You know, Jewish communities are often famous for their rabbi selection process and then separation experiences from rabbis. And when I was a teenager, we had a Rabbi Gelberman who was super emotional in his style. And at some point, my father was president of the community at that point. And at some point, I had this vague sense as a teenager, there just seemed to be a lot of these hurried meetings with whispered conversations going on in the living room. And then at some point, Rabbi Gelberman disappeared. And there were some intuitions of sexual improprieties. And then I had a recollection in those days. We had our youth group meetings in Arnold Erkin's living room. Their house was right across from the Jewish Center. And I had these memories of Rabbi Gelberman always sat next to Linda Brown, who was a very attractive young lady a year ahead of me in high school. And I had a recollection of him always having his hand on Linda Brown's knee. And I had always wanted to have my hand on Linda Brown's knee. And years later, I came across an article, I think, in the Saturday Evening Post about sort of religious charlatans, and it prominently featured a Rabbi Gelberman who evidently was fleecing rich widows at that time. So I think that was one of the more unfortunate experiences in the Princeton Jewish community's history of recruiting rabbis. And then later there was a rabbi who was quite an interesting guy. I think his name was Gendler. Barbara might have a better memory of him, who was the complete opposite, a very cerebral guy, very empathetic. He got in trouble because this is, I think, after I was away at university. So when the Six-Day War happened, 1967, I think, mm-hmm. You know, he got up and made a pacifist sermon, I think, so he didn't relish this great Jewish victory over the, Arab aggressors. And so that created a huge schism, I think, in the community. I'm not sure the history of whether that ultimately ended up in him leaving. And then I subsequently learned that he ended up spending time with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who you may remember, a.k.a. Baba Ramdas, who were kind of the pioneers of and celebrators of LSD and psilocybin. So he spent time with a community they had down in Cuernavaca, Mexico. And then he ended up as the Jewish chaplain at Andover in Massachusetts. And when my younger sister, who was very close to him when he was in Princeton, she was a teenager while he was a rabbi, and she got married up in the Boston area, and he ended up officiating at her wedding.
Oh, sweet. So are there other, I know you've thought about this some, I'm wondering if there are other issues or memories or comments that you'd like to make about your life in Princeton and your observations over the years?
I'm trying to think whether there's anything else that I've left out. Another high school memory, well, a couple things is, you know, now you hear stories of parents getting in trouble with letting their kids walk around. I think there was about several years ago, there was a upper middle class couple in Bethesda, Maryland, that got prosecuted for letting their 8- and 10-year-old walk to the park by themselves. And parents that let their kids go to the grocery store to get the milk are known as free range parents. But, you know, when I was growing up, you know, even from the age of 5 or 6, we would walk to school. There would be people that usually older students appointed as crossing guards. They'd have a little diagonal thing, and they would be out at the corner of Moore Street and Wiggins, for example, when I had to walk from Jefferson Road. I rode my bicycle all around town, you know, from the age of 8 or so. Mm-hmm. And at Halloween, we used to, you know, the parents would make the costumes with the kids. You would just go around to the neighbors in your immediate neighborhood. You mostly got apples and cookies and maybe some candy corn. There was no package candy. And when I was raising my kids, we lived in a neighborhood where there were no sidewalks and nobody, you know, the kids didn't come to the door on Halloween. And when I moved back to Jefferson Road, I was looking forward. When I moved back to Princeton, I kind of perversely bought a house one block from where I grew up on Jefferson Road. And so I was looking forward to my first Halloween here and meeting some of the neighborhood kids and all that. And so I went out and I bought a couple of bags of candy, and the bell starts ringing around, you know, 5 o'clock, and then it rings 10 seconds later. And there was just a line of kids from my house out to the street. And I ran out of candy within about half, you know, I thought I'd overstock, but I ran out of candy within half an hour. And, you know, it turns out that that from miles around, not even just from Princeton, but from out in Skillman and West Windsor, parents that lived where these large single-family developments would put their kids into the SUV and bring them to the 3 or 4 blocks of Jefferson Road. And so there was just this horde of kids coming up one after the other and ringing the bell. And so anyway, I ran out of candy after 30 minutes. And in the subsequent years, I turned the lights out and hid in the attic. But it was a complete, you know, and everybody would have store-bought costumes, the parents escorting them. And I really think, you know, certainly in a town like Princeton, I don't think it's any more dangerous for a kid to walk around town than it was when I was growing up. Though I do have one memory where I was uptown, I must have been 8 or 9 years old, I was uptown by myself, and some man approached me and asked me to show him Carnegie Lake, and I went with him. You know, it was like, and at that point, Carnegie Lake was kind of woods. There wasn't much around there. And I took him down there. We walked around. And then he took me back to, nothing happened. But in retrospect, I realized that was one of the stupidest things I ever did.
Well, thank goodness you're still here.
Yeah, live to tell the tale.
Right, you did.
The contrast between Halloween when I was growing up and, you know, today is really incredible.
Well, Peter, thank you. This has been a very sort of comprehensive picture of, you know, both growing up here, being away, and coming back, and sort of this experience you've had about, you know, where Princeton fits into your life, and it really will enhance the way this project was intending to focus. So, thank you very much for your participation in this.
Good. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.